Blog Talk Radio.
What's wrong with you?
It's either this show or indigestion. I hope it's indigestion.
Why?
It'll get better in a little while.
Here's hoping. Anyway, good evening and welcome to Blue Shirt Banner Radio, Wednesday night edition. My name is Jim, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, my friend, my partner in crime, Eddie. How are you this evening?
I'm doing very well, Jim. And I'm recovering from last night's show, and I'm also very happy that the Rangers played very well last night. So I'm in good spirit.
That's right. We had a
great
loss, and then of course we had that excellent interview with P.A. Parenteau. If you missed it, well, you missed a lot. actually, I'm just kidding, Mitch, we did not have P.A. Parenteau last night, as expected. Fell through at the last minute. Maybe next week we'll see what happens. But tonight we got a great show for you, as always. We will be joined in just a few minutes by Jess Rubenstein from the Prospect Park. He's been on the show with both of us before, and he is one of our go-to guys when it comes to the youngsters coming up through the Ranger system. And then at about 9 o'clock, we are going to be joined by former New York Ranger Bob Brook, who played for the Rangers in the mid-80s, as did most of the Rangers that come on this show. We're real good at getting these guys from the 80s, Eddie. What do you figure, 15 years from now, we'll have Sean Avery on the show?
Could be. I guarantee if I approach Sean about doing the show, he'd do it. He's a guy who's on the cutting edge. You know, he likes all the new stuff. He likes to keep young. He's always going to that Bonnaroo Festival to watch those bands that I absolutely hate that do an incessant 50-minute songs like Fish. But, I mean, we got the 89-90 team pretty much covered here, Jim.
It's almost, top to bottom. We've had about somewhere between 8 and 10 of those guys on. It's pretty amazing. And it's funny how seems like now we've had so many of these guys on that they're all connected somehow, one way or the other. We're becoming 6 degrees of Blue Shirt Banner Radio separation, so to speak.
Yeah.
And we'll explain a little bit more about that later when we have Bob on. Let's get right to it. I think this is Jess calling in. I think he's on Skype. Jess, is that you?
I'm here.
Hey Jess, good evening. Welcome to the program.
Oh, good morning, boy, or good afternoon, guys. It's been fun. You know, the last couple of weeks, it's the most rewarding time of the year for me because of, you know, when you get to see the kids that you've been, you know, propping out for the last couple of years come through and show the Ranger world that they are for real, it's always a good feeling. You know, it's Mark Stahl's birthday, so don't forget to wish him a happy birthday.
That's right.
He's 23.
Happy birthday, Mark Stahl.
He's 23. And
wow.
You guess, you know, well, think about it. You know, in 23, he's still really young. And
oh, yeah.
You know, you think about the Rangers. Like you guys saw, you know, you guys were talking about how jazzed you are about the kids. Well, you guys saw it, you know, with your own eyes watching, you know, the World Juniors. There's some talent coming. And with the next couple of years, you know, despite, you know, the problems and issues that fans have with Glenn Sather, this team is actually on its way up, and it's going to be a good time to be a Ranger fan again.
Most definitely. Every time I just want to say, every time I talk to Jess, I get so excited because I feel like I want to go out and tell the world, every Ranger fan I know, that the future looks good. But they never want to hear about the future. They're like, we've heard it before. But this isn't, you're not talking about one or two guys you're talking about. You're talking about a lot of young guys in college and in juniors that are playing so well. It's not just one guy like, you know, a Hugh Jessamine, or it's a different kind of animal now. And every time I talk to Jess, I get so excited. I mean, I hear about this. And now I heard another guy who I wasn't aware of, this guy, Chris Doyle. I wasn't aware of him, and you wrote something about him today, and I got excited all over again. So,
Doyle's one of those kids who needed a change of scenery, and you know he had some off ice issues. He still does over his head, but it's one of those situations where he's playing on one of the best teams in the Quebec League to be playing for, the Victoria Tigres, and this change of scenery is kind of like giving him part wake up call and two part a chance to, you know, start over, and he's taking advantage of it, and that's what you want to see. You know, we got Ryan Bourque in action tonight. He's in the Q League too. He's already got an assist for the evening, according to my stats. And you know, it's like you guys saw on Facebook, Ethan Warwick got named to the Ontario Hockey League. Excuse me, the Ontario Hockey League All-Star team. And to be honest, I think Warwick is probably one of the best prospects the Rangers have, bar none. He's being trained by Doug Gilmore. He's a rugged big body type who can play with soft, you know, with a small finesse type player skill. Anybody that can get access to YouTube, type in Kingston Frontenac, and you can get to see, you know, video highlights of Warwick in action. He's a great playmaker. He's a solid scorer. You need some work on his defensive end, but, you know, every kid does. But I think right now, you know, you guys saw the World Juniors and the play of the three kids for the U.S. I think Warwick's doing better than those three, as it is. I think Warwick right now is my choice for Ranger Prospect of the Year.
Wow.
So you think Warwick is ahead in his development, ahead of Kreider at this point?
Yes.
That's the pan?
Well, yeah. Yes, he is, because he has the advantage. Well, he's the advantage of he's being trained by Doug Gilmore, and and you look at the quality of players that Warwick has gone up against. I mean, he's played against Tavares. He played against Delzato last year, and I think that when you play against quality opponents night in and night out, I mean, Warwick played against Grachoff. And he held his own. He had 32 goals as a rookie last year in the O, and that's a pretty tough thing to do in that league. He's gone up against Taylor Hall, who's going to be the number one pick in the next draft. And he you can't stop Hall totally, but he's held him to, you know, respectable numbers. And, you know, if you go to the OntarioHockeyLeague.com, there's a nice picture of Warwick. On their front page, they're doing a good story about the All-Star team that was named today, and he's an assistant captain. So, you know, we got Dan Girardi from that league. We got Mark Stahl from that league. Got Ryan Callahan from that league. So we're not talking about, you know, guys that haven't come to the Rangers and help. Werick has good skating, really smart hockey sense. And I'll tell you what, if you get to, if you look at the current issue of the Blue Shirt Bulletin, he's got probably, he did probably the most extensive and intelligent interview I've ever done with a Ranger prospect.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what came out of that interview? What you glean from that?
Well, he knows that he's got a lot to learn. He relishes the opportunity to work with somebody like a Doug Gilmore, who spent so many years in the National Hockey League. And, you know, he's down to earth. And, you know, he's also, would you believe, while he's doing a full-time hockey career with Kingston, he's attending full-time classes at Queen's University. So you're talking about a pretty, you know, pretty intelligent and pretty well-rounded person for just an 18-year-old.
I like that. That was something that I got from when we talked to Chris Kreider. The same thing, a very intelligent guy, off the ice, looking, you know, but he's taking his schoolwork seriously. And I think that says a lot about the character, and he's working with Doug Gilmore, terrific two-way player, great. So that really does speak volumes, and it does show you why you're so high on him, as rating him the number one prospect right now, ahead of Stepan and Kreider, which I'm glad to hear. Keep them coming, Jess. Keep them coming.
Well, you know, we may have a dislike of Glenn Sather, and, you know, it's understandable given 10 years of, you know, what we've been through, but we also got to give him some credit. He assembled a really good scouting staff led by Gordy Clark, and Clark has assembled a scouting staff that I think is one of the best in the National Hockey League. He, you know, Clark and Krista Rockstrom have done a very good job of finding us players, not in the first or second round, but when you go third, fourth, you know, and fifth, when you can get players in those situations. I'll give you a good example. There's a kid in Michigan, Carl Hagelin, who's their leading scorer. I mean, he was a defensive whiz to begin with, but now he's showing some offense, and he's playing for one of the top programs in college hockey, the Michigan Wolverines. And we're looking at a kid who's, you know, he's got 10 goals, 12 assists in that area, and he's an intelligent kid. And the Rangers have been going not for just pure talent, but they're going for smart kids. Derek Steppen, gone to Wisconsin, which gave us Mike Richter. Smart kid. Chris Kreider's playing for Boston College. And, you know, I told people before the World Juniors to not look at the numbers that he's putting up. And Kreider is no Hugh Jessman. And I think anybody that watched any of the World Juniors We'll say that for sure, that the Rangers did make a good pick with the young man.
Oh.
And you guys have talked to him. We're talking about a kid who's a lot more ahead of his development than anybody expected.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, and you're right. His stats in college weren't that all that great, you know, on the ice and the. And like you said, don't pay attention to that. And he shined. He got that hat trick versus Latvia. You know, it's not just one guy, the Rangers putting their eggs all in one basket. You're right. The credit's got to go to Gordy Clark and his staff for not just giving us one, but we got a handful of guys that, you know, listen, you know, I know how you feel about Glenn Sather, and most of us feel about Glenn Sather. It's hard to give him credit. We give him credit in this regard, for sure. But hopefully by the time Michael Roosevelt and Wade Redden's contracts are up, these guys will be playing, and it'll be all, you know, I can't wait. I wish I had a time machine. We could go to 2014 already, so we can get going.
I don't think we have to wait that long. I think we're going to start seeing these kids in, you know, I'm pretty sure Derek Steppen is going to leave Wisconsin after this year to sign with the Rangers. The Rangers will get Ryan McDonough, and, you know, they're going to have to start creating spaces for them. So, you know, you can't keep putting people in Hartford, so somebody's going to have to go, and, you know, either they're going to buy them out and eat some money, or they'll find another Bob Gainey to take them off our hands. But, you know,
it's very true. You know, hopefully
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, I mean, too bad there ain't any more Bob Gainey's around. We need a couple more to bamboozle. And, you know, when I used that word the last time, and you mentioned this guy earlier, I wanted to touch upon him because he's kind of, I don't know, I've been hearing mixed things about McDonough. I said he bamboozled McDonough in that trade. What is the status of McDonough right now, Ryan McDonough? Has his play regressed, or where is he right now?
He's doing a good job. Wisconsin is the number 3 ranked team in college hockey. And in addition to that, they're also one of the top defensive teams in college hockey. I mean, their defense is probably the stingiest in college hockey. They're giving up maybe less than 2 goals a game. And you can't do that if you're not getting goaltending and you're not getting defensive work. And this, again, it goes back to people who look at, you know, stats and say, well, wow, he doesn't have any points. Well, McDonough is not going to go out and be a Brian Leetch. I'm sorry.
Right.
But what he will do is he will, you come across into his crease, he'll knock you on your rear end. You touch one of his teammates, he will knock you on your rear end. If you're trying to cross into his area, he's going to knock you on your rear end. And see, they don't put out, you know, he's got 5 hits in a
right.
game.
Right.
But to me, what I want to know is at the end of the game, did he hurt the team? Yeah, he had a couple of games where he took a bad penalty here and there. But he's, you know, to use a Gordy Cork catchphrase, he did things in an active participation.
Right.
And I'd rather see him take a penalty for knocking somebody on their rear than getting a stick foul or a tripping call, which is, you know, we're all old hockey fans. You know,
right.
when you get a slash, when you get a tripping call, it's basically because you got caught out of position, got caught off guard, or you were just plain lazy. You'll never find that from Ryan McDonough.
Now, Jess, would you say that when we first talked to you about Ryan, we were, you know, I kind of got the impression, or maybe your analysis was, we were kind of like stuck between whether he was going to be offensive or defensive. Does it look now he's headed towards more of a shutdown defenseman type player?
No, actually, you know, I don't want to. I'm not going to say that because. He plays for Wisconsin and Mike Eaves, and Mike Eaves is one of the most defensive-minded coaches in college hockey. It's just the same thing with Derek Stefan. You know, I mean, Stefan wasn't putting up numbers until maybe about 2 weeks before the World Juniors. With Wisconsin, their MO is defense first. They want to shut you down and then let the offense counterattack. So I'm not going to shut the door on McDonough's offense right about now. I think he's got it in him to chip in, you know, 5 to 10 goals in a season. I mean, really, you know, I don't think we're going to see many, you know, 15, 20 goal defensemen, even if we have Michael Delzato in the system.
Okay.
And you got to remember that John Tortorella's system is not built upon goal scoring from the defense. It's built on the defenseman who can make that first pass, and the Rangers have got defensemen who can make that first pass.
Right. So I mean, so that's good news on McDonough, and you know, I'm glad to hear that because I was a little worried about the kick. You know, you hear things, but then when. Like, I've dubbed you the prospect guru right now, and when I hear from the prospect guru, I feel a lot better because
well,
I don't want
to. Well, thank you, Chris.
Well,
Well, thank you for the kind words. You know, with kids, and I stress this the most, it is a matter of you should see where their heart and their desire is. And, you know, nobody thought Brandon Dubinsky was going to be an NHL player when he was first drafted. They said he couldn't skate, he couldn't do this, he couldn't do that. Said the same thing about Ryan Callahan. And one of the advantages that I have is I do get to know these kids and I get to talk to them. And because I do, you know, they don't teach you how to have a heart. They don't teach you how to have a desire or a dream. You have to have that on your own. And, you know, that's the thing about the Ranger kids. I mean, I'll give you an example of a mistake I made. I thought that, you know, Danny Maggio, he was the sixth-round pick in the 2009. I thought he was, you know, 6'3", about 210. He's being trained by Jeff Bookaboom. I'm figuring, hey, here's a big monster. You know, he's going to be a shutdown defenseman. No, it turns out that the big kid is actually more offensive than he is defensive. He's like fourth in the Ontario League with 9 goals. I mean,
yeah. So sometimes it doesn't, you know, the physical maybe attributes of a guy don't really tell you what he's going to be. I mean, you know. And speaking of Bookaboom, his son Brock plays right. In the OHL, I think?
Yeah, for the Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds.
What type of player is he?
You know, it's the funny thing about Bookaboom. If I told you that young Brock is actually more of an offensive player than his dad ever was, would you be shocked? You know?
No, not really. Book was known for his hitting. And
hard to be less of an offensive player, no?
But
how is Brock?
Yeah, Brock's actually doing pretty good. He plays for Sault Ste. Marie. They call him the Sioux. He's a marvelous kid. He's a couple inches shorter than his dad, and he plays a good offensive role. You know, it's funny because you know, Alfie Samuelson, his son Philip, plays for UMass.
Oh,
and
really?
Yeah, and he's, you know, okay, you want to talk about opposite of your dear old dad? The Philip Samuelson is a offensive minded defenseman. He isn't physical, he doesn't really like to hit, and he would be more of a candidate for Lady Bing than anything else.
Wow,
and,
it's a real departure from dear old dad.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that all three of us are at that age where we can go, oh wow, you know. I was joking with somebody the other day. It's when I looked at the midterm rankings, I said, whoever thought I would see the day where a Bookaboom would be ranked higher for a draft than a Messier or a Sutter?
Right.
But Brock Bookaboom, I'd say, is about a third round pick, and he's going to be a serviceable defenseman. I don't think he'll be a star, but I think he'll be a good 4 or 5, and that's not a bad thing. You know, that's not a bad thing either. It's still a top 4 defender.
Keep the lineage going. The NHL. Family tradition going. I'm happy for that. Listen, I'm sure Jeff would be happy anything that his son does. You know, and
look at Ryan Bork, and you know, Bork's coming. He's following in his father's footsteps, so he's gone out of his way to be a forward instead of a defenseman. But he's very much like his dad when it comes to hockey smarts. He's if that kid was 6'1", 6'2", nobody would be questioning him, but he's a generous 5'9".
Right.
But he's one of the most ferocious forecheckers I've seen out there.
Now, Jess, let me ask you about Ryan, because, it was said that he was asked to play a more defensive role in the junior championships, especially against Canada, And it looked like he fulfilled that role. It looks a little bit that he has a little bit more flexibility than we once thought. The word out on him was he was a little bit too fancy with the puck, a little bit too much stick handling. Have you seen him develop? And was that true in your assessment of the World Juniors with Bork's play?
You want to know what? I don't know. I don't know what Dean Blaise did to get players to do things that were kind of out of character. That wasn't the Ryan Bork that I'd seen for Quebec. It's another sign that I don't think people realize is you're asking a person who's been a star on his team to accept a lesser role, a defensive type role, and do it and sacrifice part of your game. And Ryan Bork did that. I mean, I don't want to use the shock, but I'll say impressed by the unselfishness of him. Bork's playing for a contract over the next couple of years. And, if he was a selfish player, he would have been looking to pad his numbers. But there he was on the penalty kill, for Team USA. And that penalty kill was pretty darn good, during that World Junior. And you give credit to a kid like that who's willing to put aside personal glory for the good of the team. I mean, he is a good, playmaker. I think that's his future at the NHL level. But it's sure nice to know that, he also comes back and plays some pretty solid defense.
Oh, it's great to know that he'll sacrifice, like you said, you put it so well, the personal glory or maybe showcasing himself, he decided to put that on the back burner for the team effort. And that's the kind of guys you want on your team. Let's face it, you want those type of guys in your corner and your lineup. No showboating. And he converted his game, and that Canada power play was stacked. I mean, you're playing against some of the best, and the fact that he was very successful as well changing that role speaks to him very well. So, Ryan Bork, another guy. Do you think his size is going to hinder him if in the NHL if he gets a chance here?
I think you're going to see the same issue with him that you do with Peter Prucha. People are going to be worried because he's so small. But if Tortorella sticks around, I think Tortorella is probably going to give him the better chance of making it with the Rangers because Tortorella is used to Martin St. Louis. He knows the size. The size issue isn't as big as it should be. And I think, again, this is stereotypes and the cliches coming out when if he was 6'1", 6'2", nobody would be worried about it. We'd be talking about when he would become a Ranger instead of if he'll become a Ranger.
Right.
So, I'll toss the size part out. You look at what he just did, and he's playing for Patrick Waugh up in Quebec. So, he's playing in a system, for a coach who knows what it takes to get to the National Hockey League. And sometimes I wonder if the Rangers take that into consideration just as much as they do the player's talent. Because you look at Werick with Doug Gilmore and Ryan Bork with, Patrick Waugh, and even Roman Horick, who's out in Chilliwack. He's being coached by Mark Cavishield. But Chilliwack is a team that Glenn Sather and Brian Bork own a piece of. So, Havishield has coached everywhere. Thomas Kondratik, he's being coached by the guy that was coaching Team Canada, Willie Desjardins. And Lon Morikin, who coached Chicago, the Blackhawks, and had a cup of coffee as an Islander coach, is coaching Sam Klassen. So, the Rangers are getting players who are used to winning. And that, too, you don't see that show up in the stat book. But I'll tell you what, if you go look at the standings, of the leagues that, you know, the Ranger players are playing in, you notice that only maybe two prospects are playing on losing teams. Everybody else is playing on a team that's going to make the playoffs for sure. And that's, you know, you don't teach winning. You have to experience it.
Right. And I wonder, maybe there is something to that. The Rangers are purposely having these, they're drafting players who have coaches that really can, you know, they really can teach you what it takes to play at the NHL level. I mean, you got a lot of guys there. It's like 5-6 guys. It really kind of, you don't really think coincidence is playing a role in this. This could be an actual, and if that is true, I'll tell you, I would love to give credit to this Ranger organization. If that's true, you know, I'll be the first one to admit it. Listen, I'm not going to go on this state of rant, but, you know, I give props when they're due, and Gordy Clark and as you even told me the last time we talked about Tom Rennie, who put a lot of this stuff in place that was nothing before Tom Rennie. So, you know, as much as sometimes I'll wander off the path and start, you know, going off on certain GMs and coaches, I give credit where credit is due. So hopefully this is a good thing.
Yeah, no, you're talking to the one person who was Rich Carpinello of the Journal.
Right.
Both of us were anti-Sather from before he was hired. We, you know, I have the advantage of living out west, so I was watching the Oilers and what they were going through, and, you know, I'll be the first to admit that I don't like Glenn Sather. But like you said, you got to give a guy credit when credit's due. Neil Smith left that Ranger prospect system, I mean, less than barren. I mean, they were stocking Hartford with, you know, waiver pickups, and everybody else was garbage. And now they're becoming more and more filled with current draft picks, and it's a good thing because, you know, these kids are growing up together, and you know, as I said earlier, it's going to be a good time to be a Ranger fan in the next couple of years. It really will be.
Good. How about you, Jim?
That's what we
want to
hear.
That's what we want to hear. I want to drink the Kool-Aid again. I want to pass the Kool-Aid around to everybody.
I turned 50, you know, in last May, and one of the things I was joking is that, you know, what would be really sweet is if by the time I turn 54, I'll get my second Ranger Cup in my lifetime. Wouldn't it be ironic that when I'm 54, we have a second cup? And then I look at the prospects, and I'm going, you know, that's a really good possibility.
I know. Even in the beginning of the show, when you told us to wish Mark Stoll a happy birthday, and happy birthday, Mark. I know you're listening. You know, it's true. He's only 23, and he's already, you know, this guy. All right, I think he played a brilliant game last night. He played an awesome game last night, and he is a shutdown defenseman already at 23. And we think of him as a guy who's been around for a while, you know? And I love it. I love that you got Delzato at 19. You know, I think piece by piece, this team will come together. And I said 2 to 3 years, they're going to be an Eastern Conference fourth. I said this before the season started, and mainly because I talked to the prospect guru, I talked to some other people, and I really do get jazzed to use that word. I use that word a lot, but I do get jazzed. So who else is on the radar and on the horizon for the Ranger fans to get excited about that maybe not getting so much press, so Ranger fans don't know anything or a little about, Jeff?
I would have to say Roman Horick of the Chilliwack Bruins. I just saw him Sunday up in Portland, and this kid is like an amazing face-off wizard. I've seen him in 3 games, and I'm still waiting. He took 24 faceoffs and was 19-5 for the game. And that's probably that was probably his worst game percentage wise that I had seen. I mean, he's usually 80-90%. He's got a style to faceoffs that's just unbelievable. And I think he's going to be a good player. Scott Stacer, who's playing for Owen Sound. Owen Sound is rebuilding right now. He's if he was on a team that had a better defense, everybody would be going crazy. But Stacer, I think, is actually a better goalie prospect than even Chad Johnson is. Stacer last year stoned John Tavares. He stoned Taylor Hall. And, you know, he just robbed point blank Michael Delzato in a game that, you know, and this was a kid that was 17 and he was doing this. And now he's doing it at 18. He'll spend another year at 19, maybe a couple of years at Hartford by that 2014 season. I wouldn't be surprised if he's up playing for the Rangers as a backup, or, you know, we don't know what's going to happen down the road, but I always believe it's always nice to have more goalies than you have spots for, because you can turn a goalie into a good player.
Yeah. Now, and I just want to ask him one question about. Now, we talked about, you mentioned Taylor Hall and John Tavares, and just for my own edification, who do you think at this juncture is the better player? Is Tavares? I mean, well, obviously Tavares is in the NHL, but going into the how do you rate Taylor Hall going into the NHL as compared to when Tavares first went into the NHL?
To be honest, I actually have been more of a Taylor Hall fan than I was a Tavares fan. Taylor Hall is, you know, he's going to get blamed for Canada's not winning the gold, but I think that's a bunch of bull. His question is he's just got to mature emotionally and a little bit physically too. He's a rock solid 5-tool player. I think he's better than him, but I'll tell you what. You know, I'm going to say I'm biased because, my local team is the Portland Winterhawks, so I'm becoming a Winterhawk fan. But the Winterhawks are going to have 5 players in the first 2 rounds this year. And if the Rangers, no matter where they pick, can get a shot at any one of these 5 players, you're going to get a good player, a really good player. The best of the bunch I don't think we have a shot for. That's Nino Niederreiter. He's a Swiss kid that made the all-media team for the World Juniors. He's the real deal, that kid. He is the best Swiss player, I think, ever to come out of Switzerland.
Wow. I just like his name, Nino Niedermeyer.
Oh, can you just imagine? You know, Mal, can you imagine Nino Niedermeyer as a Ranger? The way those fans would be chanting Nino.
I love it.
To be honest, I was really hoping he'd have kind of like a middle of the road season, so he'd be there. Because I project the Rangers to be in the 15-20 range when it comes to drafting. And at the beginning of the season, that's where I was seeing Nino, and then Nino put on that performance at the World Juniors. The kid's not going to be there unless the Rangers, you know, don't make the playoffs. And I think the Rangers will make probably, 7-8 seed, 1 round of the playoffs. And that's okay. I can live with that this year.
In other words, the status quo.
Yeah, but, I'm going to disagree with you, Jim, on it being status quo. I think, Tortorella is trying to do something, and I think, all of us Ranger fans, we have to admit that at times we're the most impatient and, ill-tempered bunch in the NHL. You know, we want to win. We want to win now. And, and I do believe we do have a right to be expecting more, seeing how we're now, 15 years away from 94. But
we don't talk about that word.
Yeah, Well,
but
no,
I know,
but I think you know, and I've been saying this, and I wrote this at the magazine website, that patience is a must now. You know, we Ranger fans have got us to also change ourselves. We need to stop, you know, saying, you know, I want this guy here tomorrow. I want this guy here, you know, yesterday. We've got to allow these kids a chance to develop naturally, to let them build their bodies. You know, like everybody was wanting Grachev this year, and I'm, you know, and I'll tell you what, Grachev, as far as I'm concerned, is progressing right on schedule. He's, you know, to get his numbers, he's only 19.
Right.
Let's not push him to the point. Let that body get physically, you know, maturing, and let it do it natural. And, you know, let's not do it under you know, the microscope of the New York Ranger fans.
Yeah, well, I think when you know, the majority of Ranger fans, and I don't mean this disparaging you. I mean, you put it nicely, but they're an impatient bunch, and everything is now, 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 and they've been burned by the waiting process in the past. But, you know, in the salary cap era, it's a different ballgame than it was before. And I think you really have to, it behooves yourself as a Ranger fan to sit back and wait and let these guys develop. You got to be pleased. You know, Ranger fans out there, you complain about the Reds, and yes, that's of course, you got total validity there. But We're moving to a younger team. I mean, we used to have teams that were chock full of veterans that were going nowhere. You mentioned Neil Smith at the end of his tenure, how old it got. And now we've got Ryan Callahan, Brandon Dubinsky, even Dan Girardi, you want to throw him in there. Matt Gilroy's 25. You got Stahl. We got a lot. We got Anisimov. We got a lot of young players on this team. And I think that sometimes, you know, we cried and cried, the Ranger fans cried and cried to get younger, and we're younger. And it's a waiting game. This is what happens, you know, and you're right. We really should, you know, but you know what happens? The games come on, we get all involved in the game, and we all get crazy, including me. But, you know, long range, this team is making some progress, but it's hard to convince the diehard Ranger fan who's been burned so many times. It's even hard to convince some of these experts I talk to. They don't believe it, you know. I try to tell them, but, hey, you know, listen, that's, you know, there. But you're right.
Well,
patience is the key.
You know, as an example, how about, you know, last night, Mike Emmerich mentioned it during the telecast, the Rangers had 6 draft picks on the ice last night. What was the last season where they probably had 6 of their own draft picks on the ice?
Right.
They're getting there. They're getting there.
Yeah, you know, Jim, you know, and the thing about it, too, is those aren't the best draft picks. Those kids are coming. I mean, the 2008 draft, in my book, was the best ever draft for the Rangers. I mean, you got Delzato's already there. Grachev is in Hartford. You guys saw what Stefan is like. And there's Tomas Kondratic, who, you know, I think needed to go back to the Western Hockey League to learn some maturity and, you know, kind of get grounded. And he's turned into a nice shutdown defenseman. And he's got size, and he's got skill, and he's, you know, he's there. Dale Weiss is down in Hartford. So you're looking at 5 kids out of 1 draft coming up and eventually being National Hockey League players. The rule of thumb has always been, if you can get 2 players out of a draft, it's a good draft, but 5 is unheard of, and the Rangers have a shot at that.
Right. Hey, how about a couple of the guys that you talk about and maybe aren't really on most of our radars? How about Tyson Dozak? Is it Dozak or Dozak?
Dozak, and I think he took a step backwards.
I know he's a guy you've been high on.
He really disappointed me. I really thought that he had gotten the message last year with Kelowna, but, you know, he's got a lot of players in front of him, but I guess we can't teach a mean streak into somebody, and he needs to stop being the gentle giant. I mean, he's playing for Charlotte now, and you know, and it's kind of, you know, I don't want to say sad to see, but I think that, you know, there are guys who just simply don't get the message, and eventually they find themselves being either career minor leaguers or eventually leaving. You know, take a look at, you know, like that kid Anton LaFleur. He was a second round draft pick, and he's not even playing hockey anymore, and he's only 21. So Dozak, I would say, has pushed himself off the radar. There's, you know, he's being passed by Sam Klassen, Danny Maggio, Ryan McDonough, and, you know, you're going to see a turnover in a changing of the guard in the next year or two of the Ranger defense, complete turnaround, because they have these kids that they're going to have to find spots for, and somebody's going to have to make way for them. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Rangers have to make a tough decision and start moving people like a Dan Girardi.
I think the trading deadline, I think they're going to go bananas. They got to clear a lot. There's a lot of guys. I mean, we weren't really going to talk about Hartford too much, but they got a plethora of guys down there that need to go. I mean, we haven't even talked on them, the Sowers and the Potters and the those guys got to be moved. There's something's got to go on with them. And even Bobby Sanguinetti seems to be in some kind of limbo down there. And you know, you got guys right now pushing. I think Heikkinen really should have gotten more of a chance. I think he needs to see some power play time, or Heikkinen, or whatever they're saying it nowadays. But you know, I would have loved to see a little bit more of him. I think he's starting to come around with the. His offense, and I think he's got a good shot. And, you know, it's a good problem. It's a good problem, but I think that you're going to see, especially with, you know, you keep having these good drafts and these good guys, there's just going to be not enough room. And you were saying that Werick was probably your favorite out of all the prospects.
I think Werick's definitely, you know, a future first liner. Right now, the one area that I think the Rangers need is right-handed, or right wings. They're loaded up on centers and left wings. So we need another right wing. I like the way Kreider and Stefan, I mean, have this almost, I don't know, insane chemistry that, you know, you're looking at guys that played together for a couple of days at a camp in the summer, and then they played a couple of days at the second camp right before the World Juniors, and then at the World Juniors they just, I mean, they meshed. The USA power play, the first unit was Stefan and Kreider. I mean, that's our good luck.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, I asked Chris this, and actually Jim asked him, and I want, you've been around a lot of these guys, and you know them better than we do, but we asked him, did him and Ryan Bork ever talk about being on the Rangers together, and they said they never have. Do you buy that? Do you think they've actually, you know, if you had to come up with, you know, your own thoughts on that, what would you think?
I would agree with you. Hockey players are superstitious. And, you know, they're also an honest group. I think that, you know, deep down inside, they'll tell you off the record, and they might wink at you when they say it, but I think they'd like it to happen, and, you know, they don't want to jinx it. You know, you take away a bit of their, you know, their power when you say, well, yeah, I can't wait to get up there with Stefan and play with him. You kind of jinx them. I mean, the hockey players are so weird, you know. They're the most superstitious of the bunch. So I do think that they haven't talked publicly or out loud, but I know it's in the back of their minds. because, hey, let's be honest, Stefan and Kreider were unbelievable together, just like Stefan and Bork was on the power, on the penalty kill.
Yeah. No. You know, it's you know, it's good. I didn't really pick up on that chemistry, but you did, and you know, I was too busy. I have to say, and this is something I want to you know, I'm gonna go off a little bit. You know, guys, I've been really sedate so far in the show, but you know, the United States did a you know, the coverage of this World Junior Championships. The NHL should have really made a play to get these games on a major network. I'm not saying live, but, you know, on a Saturday afternoon, they could have had this game in a repeat. And half the nation wouldn't even known it was a repeat unless it was people like us following the game. And they might have been, rather than putting on with poker or whatever they're putting on, you know, what's that thing when the horses jump over the thing there? What do you call it?
Equestrian.
The equestrian event. Put on the junior championships. That was an historic moment. I don't care. It was curling. It was an historic moment in United States history. Don't they understand that Canada is? I mean, they own this. This is. Wasn't it one of the most popular watched events in Canada ever? And the United States television networks passed on it. They could have shown it, and the country could have been turned on to hockey. And it was a proud moment. Just I'm gonna tell you. The last time I got that excited over a hockey game had to be like, I have to say, either the Rangers winning the cup, or I won't go that crazy, but the Rangers in 96 in a playoff win where I jumped out of my seat. I was high-fiving my wife. I was going crazy when they won that thing. And it's just a shame that it just didn't get the press in the United States. It just
I'll agree with you there. You know, and, you know, NBC's got the Olympics coming right up, and the fact that this is actually, you know, the second straight U.S. team to win a gold medal. The under-18 team won a gold medal. And, well, actually, even our under-17 team won a challenge competition that was going on at the same time as the World Juniors. And it is sad that, you know, that most of the United States audience, and, you know, I mean, I don't know how many households the NHL Network gets, but, you know, I give credit to the up in Canada. Canada, the three Quebec League, or I mean, not the three Quebec League, but the three Canadian Junior Leagues, they all made sure that nobody played, with the exception of a couple of makeup games.
Right.
The majority of Canadian teams didn't play that night, and so that, you know, the audience was there, and it was like you said. TSN reported that the first Canada U.S. matchup on New Year's Eve was something like the third watched broadcast of all time, and that's New Year's Eve when people are getting ready to go out and go party. So I would love to see the numbers for what the final was for TSN. Because that was, you know, if you couldn't watch that game, hockey fan or not, and not get excited and not enjoy it, I'm sorry. I don't think anything will get you excited.
I was as nervous as if it were the Rangers out there in that overtime. I was, you know, and it seemed like a Ranger game because they blew the lead in the third period again. And I was like, I felt like I was a comfortable position, but then I was kind of uncomfortable because they won the game. And then I was ecstatic. I was like, unbelievable. And I was just going crazy. And I was like, you know, and listen, I'm a cynic. And, you know, a lot of times I don't buy into a lot of patriotic hoopla and the whole bit. But I felt proud of being from the United States and beating those damn Canadians. Because, as you know, those Canadians are arrogant about their hockey. That's their native sport, and justifiably so. But they gave us no shot, you know, and, you know, they did show some class. They didn't boo all that much in the ceremonies and all that. But, you know, it's so I have to say, I was excited. I just wish, hey, they just should have thrown it on repeats on Channel 4. Again, like I told you, people would have watched and thought it was live. Because, you know, the guy from Alabama flicking around his channels, you know. You know, he says, oh, well, let me watch this. Some guy skating around. Oh, this is exciting. USA. Well, I love that. Anything with the United States. He gets his gun out. They win. He shoots the gun off. And it's all great. this is how it catches on, hockey. I mean, you know, they see the exciting stuff like this. And again, I'm going to get a little bit.
Hockey catches on by random gunfire.
Well, you know, these yahoos down south, they go crazy when they celebrate. But the thing is,
well,
there goes our Alabama audience. But
yeah, our Bible Belt demographics just went to hell.
But what I'm saying is, and I touched upon this in an earlier show, when those kids sang the national anthem and knew every word to it, and they raised that banner. And again, I'm a cynical guy. It was fantastic. It was.
I wonder.
It was a proud moment. It should have been shown.
Well, they should have shown the other moment, too, in the locker room, the post-game cheer. That was a moment, too.
I didn't see that one. What was that all
that
about?
That one, let's put it this way. That one won't make broadcast television, but it's, let's just put it this way. It was a nice little military-style Jody call. With their Gatorade in their glass, they went out and kicked their. And I'll let you fill in the last couple of words.
All right. Well, I'm not going to fill them in. I'm already in a lot of trouble with people from Alabama.
Right. Oh, I'm pretty sure, Mouth, that right now that there's probably checkpoints set up south of the Mason-Dixon line, going, where's that damn Ranger fan again?
Yeah. That damn Mouth done shot his mouth off once too often.
But you know what? The more important
thing
is...
What we got here is a failure to communicate.
You know, but still, you know, the Rangers had four prospects in that tournament, and they acquitted themselves well. And that's something for us to be excited about. And now we're going to get ready... you know, we got what's coming up next will be the Memorial Cup, and that'll be televised on the NHL Network, and that's going to be worth checking out. And the same thing with the NC2As. You got Wisconsin with Derek Stepan and Ryan McDonough. Boston College should make it with Chris Kreider. So if you have channels like ESPN University the NHL Network, or even if you get the sports channels, there's going to be chances for you to see these kids play. I'm going to be enjoying the last couple of months because I think that we're going to see, you know, some really good play from our future. And the more they win now, the more they show up in Hartford and in New York with the belief that I'm going to be a winner. And that's just going to mean, like I said, I want for my 54th birthday, I want another Stanley Cup. And I think that we're right on target for that right now.
Well, I hope you're right. I'm telling you, every time I talk to the prospect guru, Jess Rubenstein, I feel better. It's always with these negative Nellies I got to deal with. Jim here, always telling me the Rangers think. He's always saying, where's your Kool-Aid now, Mal? What's going on? No, actually, Jim is very positive. And, you know, right now, we just got to stay the course and grin and bear it with some of these things that are not going so right. And so it's good to hear. Jess, are there any other guys that the Rangers should be aware of that, you know, I said I've already gone off the radar, but maybe throw it. Like this Doyle kid, what's his situation? You said that he's improved from this trade. What kind of player is he, and what kind of player was he before this transition?
Well, Doyle's kind of like you could call him Enigma, but I would say that his best characteristic is he's got a knack for scoring on the power play. He's a power play specialist. He's got a really good shot, a willingness to stand in the crease. But he's got to stop being one of the guys. I want to see Chris step to the forefront, take charge like he's doing now. I mean, last year he had 32 goals before he got hurt. He had a suspect back coming back in, and an unfortunate off ice incident where he's gotten arrested and he still has to stand trial for. And you know, he's got to turn himself around, you know, emotionally. He's got to realize that he has a chance to make money, you know, playing a game. And sometimes with these kids, you need to take a little gasoline, pour it on their backside, and light a match and get them to realize that they have an opportunity in front of them. And I think that being traded, you know, from basically his backyard. I mean, he grew up where he did in Prince Edward Island, and now he's away from home. So in this case, I think it's going to force him to finally grow up. He has the talent. You just got to somehow get the brain and the heart on the same wavelength.
Well, that's always the key with some of these guys. Hopefully he can get it straightened out and get it put together. Well, Jess, we thank you very much for coming in. And for those of you that don't check out Jess's site, make sure you do. He's at the prospectpark.blogspot.com, and he also writes for the Blue Shirt Bulletin, and you can catch him there. And Jess, we'd love to check in with you as we get closer to the end of the season, and we'll see what's going on with the prospects as we get closer to the draft.
Well, thank you, Jim. And can I just do one quick plug for my magazine?
Absolutely.
If you haven't checked out the Blue Shirt Bulletin, www.blueshirtbulletin.com, this is the only place that you can find all the Ranger beat writers, with the exception of Larry Brooks, writing for our magazine. We cover the Rangers from the drafts, which is me, all the way to the Garden. We get inside, in-depth. Our next issue is going to be a great Olympic profile. Our February issue is going to be a full under-the-microscope examination of the Rangers management. And if you join today, you also get yourself a membership in the New York Ranger Fan Club. So come check us out. We have a great magazine. It's fun. It's just, you know, it's exciting. Just like the guys here at the Blue Shirt Banter, you like them, you'll like us. And thank you guys, Mouth. I'm going to make sure I don't ride in the car with you down the highway, because I know if I get pulled over, I get a ticket. But it's always fun to be on here. You guys do a great job. The thing I love about the banter is nobody wears the rose-colored glasses. And if when they stink, you say so. When they play well, you say so. So I love reading you guys, and I really hope to see you guys come back for you guys towards the end of the season.
All right. Thanks, Jess. Take care. All the best. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care, guys.
Okay. Good night. All right, that was Jess from the Prospect Park. He is, like I said, he's one of our go-to guys for Ranger prospects. And we're just waiting for Eddie to come back with Bob Brook, which should be in about a minute or two. And we'll get down to it with Bob and talk about the Olympics coming up and his days with the Rangers. If you guys want to call in, phone number, as always, 646-478-4692. And we'll have the schedule for you for next week's shows in a couple of days. I'm not sure what we're doing. I think the Rangers, off the top of my head, I don't remember what their schedule is for next week. So we'll have to plan accordingly. And I'm not sure what guests we have scheduled for next week. January 26th, we have Ron Greschner. And then we also, like we said last night, have James Patrick coming up in the weeks ahead. We just have to coordinate that with his Sabres schedule. So give us about a minute here. Also, I think we might have P.A. Parento, the interview we were supposed to do last night. We should have that next week. We're working on that as well. So just bear with us a second. Let me see if Eddie is back.
Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah, how are you? This is Eddie. We're ready to go on the air in a couple seconds. You'll hear the show go on, hopefully.
Okay.
So I'm just going to check
looks like
in
Eddie
with
is
my...
just about ready here.
Yeah, I'm going to let them know I got you on. You're a little bit low, but I don't know if that's me. We'll check it once we get on the air. Just hold on one second
Eddie?
Here. Yeah, how
Eddie?
Are you? Yes.
We got you.
You got me?
Hi,
I've
Bob.
Got Bob.
Bob, welcome to the program.
Who's this now?
Now, this is Jim. Jim is my radio partner. This is Eddie the Mouth. And, Bob, we welcome you to the program. You're live on the air on Blue Shirt Banner Radio, and welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, people are saying you're a little bit low in the chat room. We have a chat room that goes on while the show goes on. I don't know if you can do anything about the volume. I know we can't, so whatever we have, we have. But I can hear you. I can hear you pretty.
Turn it up from this side and make sure I'm in a quiet spot.
I think we're good now. Jim, does he sound fine to you?
A little low, but better than he was.
Okay. Well, we must press on. We must continue. And Bob, I want to first of all thank you so much for coming on this show. And it's funny today. I was talking about it on that Facebook about you being on the show, and Jim, my partner here, was telling me that you got you got your shoulder dislocated by Chris Kostopoulos, who's a good friend of mine and a friend of this show. And I was asking Kotze, does he remember the hit? He doesn't remember it. Do you remember it?
Well, it happened twice, but yeah, it was...
It happened twice!
It's as much of getting caught. The old partitions between the glass stuck out about a quarter or a half an inch. And so your shoulder, you know, you're getting hit along the boards and your shoulder's sliding along the glass until it hits one of those partitions. And I was trying to slide by and just caught that. It just stopped and I kept going.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, so it's either get hit by him real hard or try and squeak by. And, the combination of the two didn't do my shoulder much good.
Wow. So, you know, it always seems that the hit... T, so to speak, always remembers the hit, but the guy who hit you doesn't remember the hits all that too much. He didn't have the pain inflicted on him. So, you know, I wanted to just start with your whole career. You know, we got some time here, and I didn't know this, but you were originally drafted by the St. Louis Blues, and I always ask this of the guests, and you remember where you were when you were picked, and how you got the news?
Sure, I just took an earpiece out, so maybe this is a little
there
bit
you
better.
Go.
Can
this
you guys
is great.
Hear me better?
Oh, now it's fantastic.
Perfect.
Excellent.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I just got a
thanks,
message
Bob.
Here from somebody who was listening to it saying, you know what, try without the earpiece, and so here we go. As far as draft goes, I do remember I was I was a freshman at Yale, and I think it was probably a week or 8 days after the draft had already occurred when somebody came up to me and said, hey, I heard you were the third pick of the St. Louis Blues. And I go, really? and then it was like, you know, it was a non-event. And nowadays I think the draft is such a big deal that – anybody who aspires to play in the NHL, I mean, they're living and dying by what happens during the draft that night.
Right. And I think the draft that you participated in was the first one that was actually to let people go into it, the Montreal Forum, where people could view it, you know, for the first time.
And maybe that's it, because I know now it's a big kind of spectator sport, not just the families of the kids that are going to be drafted, but... you know, you get fans involved, and there's tickets sold, and it's a big event. And probably televised as well, and that just wasn't the case back then.
Now, I mean, so you aren't expecting to be drafted? I mean, you know, you're in your freshman year at Yale. Somebody comes up to you and is like, the Blues drafted you. I mean, was that the case with you?
Yeah, not quite. I suppose, you know, you're in an environment at Yale where hockey was not the biggest thing on campus, and, you know, there's so many other things to do and concentrations for me, that because it wasn't a big televised event and all that stuff, that I guess I just didn't know too much about it and wasn't surrounded by people who knew too much about it. And Tim Taylor, the coach then, was awfully good to me and is still to this day very involved in USA hockey. But I don't know that Tim shared much with me about the draft either.
Right. And so, you know,
I think coming out of, you know, just if I could.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, my recollection was I played in, and this is a funny story. I was probably the last player picked to go play for the U.S. National Junior Team winter over Christmas and New Year's of my freshman year in college. And I think I got on the team because Tim Taylor kind of pried and prodded the coach in USA Hockey to take me. And so I came back from Helsinki, Finland, and I remember this. It's a funny story because we had nothing else to do Christmas Day, so we played a scrimmage game against the Canadians. And I think the Canadians wanted to intimidate absolutely everybody on our team prior to the tournament actually starting a couple days later. And so I had nothing to do. Nobody knew who I was. And I think that day I probably played as dirty as I ever have. And all of a sudden all the scouts are wondering, well, who's this Brooke kid? He seems to be standing up for himself out there. What's going on? And if it weren't for probably that scrimmage game, I still don't think anybody would have known who I was.
Now, this is for the United States Junior Team?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they had
Junior Nationals.
All right. So you're talking about what, 1977?
79. No, 79-80.
All right. So this is the same year. This is the year after the Rangers lose to Montreal in the Stanley Cup. And then they have they're playing a scrimmage against the USA Junior Nationals, right? And, I mean, you're a little bit upset.
No, I think, there's a difference between the Junior National Team and then the Olympic team that was in training right then.
Okay, all right.
And I think the Rangers played some scrimmage games, or at least one, against the potential Olympic team.
But I was saying that the Rangers played the same Canadians in the Stanley Cup the year before, and then
you
find yourself playing them in a scrimmage, right? And they're looking to intimidate you guys. I mean, that's ridiculous when you think about it.
Well, I'm talking about the Canadian junior team.
Oh, okay. I thought it was the Montreal Canadiens. My bad. I'm on some other planet right now.
No, and that was it. That was also in Helsinki, Finland, Christmas Day, 1979. And before that, I don't think I should say it differently. After that day, all of a sudden the scouts were coming up and introducing themselves to me and saying, you know, where do you go to school? How old are you?
Ah.
You know, all kinds of stuff and questions and trying to get to know who I was. And
you think
so that tournament kind of set the stage for me prior to, you know, before that tournament I wasn't thinking much about the NHL or being drafted. And after that tournament there was just an inkling because I had been introduced to some scouts.
Oh, okay. So, and this comes on in the wake of the 80 Olympic team, right? I mean,
Yeah.
So, and I noticed in that draft that a lot of people, a lot of United States players got taken by teams such as St. Louis and Minnesota, in the wake of all that. And then, it's funny because you wound up playing on the 84 team and, we want to talk a little bit about the Olympics and that whole experience that's coming up. Now, then again, it was all amateurs back then, but What kind of experience was the Olympics for you back then?
You know, it's interesting. I've been asked that a number of times, and in fact, I was at a presentation just last Friday where Rob McClanahan from the 1980 gold medal team was speaking.
Wow.
And you know, he kind of recalled some of his experiences during the course of the year, not just Lake Placid. And I think I would echo his sentiments that the season isn't all about just what happens at the Olympics. I mean, we played 65 games, 55 of them were away. So we basically spent, you know, 6 months on the road living out of suitcases, and we were young, and you know, it culminated with a trip to Sarajevo, Yugoslavia, where, you know, all of a sudden all the pressure that you were enjoying because, you were these, you know, like I said in an article I wrote for the New York Times after the Olympics, you know, we were a bunch of heroes before we had done anything heroic.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I think for the youth on our team, the youngest kids, you know, get flooded with all this pressure once the Olympics and all the media and the hoopla came down on our team, because 4 years earlier the U.S. had won gold. And that was all a burden that I think we weren't used to. We'd kind of been sheltered from that during the course of our preseason training.
Right.
But you talked a bit about, you know, the amateur side of it. And this came up last week. I would love to see the amateurs being brought back into the game. I don't know if it's possible because hockey has become such an international game and the professional ranks have blended the international game and taken all the pros. So the best we might hope for is to have a mandatory limit of how many professional players each international team could take. And
right.
That might be a nice compromise and afford some guys the opportunity to showcase themselves and, you know, the veteran players who are now pros, give them an opportunity to pass the torch, if you will, to some of the youth and amateurs coming up the ranks.
Yeah, that sounds like, that's a good proposal, because we were talking about this on last night's show. And, you know, it's all about, I guess, the promotion of the game of hockey, and that's why I have the pros in there. But I kind of refute that theory in thinking that if we had a bunch of amateurs, and say, yes, we had some pros, like, say, you know, you're allowed to have four pros, the fact that the amateurs won the gold medal, I think would carry more weight with the fan, maybe not so much of hockey, but just the Olympic fan or the sports fan who hasn't found hockey, would carry more weight if it was amateurs rather than us setting up a pro team that everybody, you know, everybody knows they're pros, they're paid. Because people like to embrace the underdog, and amateurs, you know, they're underdogs. They all have a story, they all have a background story, and the parents are there at the game, and you know, the whole showcase of it all. So I think that's a happy medium that you're kind of reaching, and a great point that you make.
Well, you know, one of the things that should be considered when thinking about the amateurs, and I guess I've been out of professional hockey long enough, but around amateur hockey ever since with my own kids and coaching and so forth, but to look at it as I now do as a business, and unfortunately professional sports is very much a big business. If you look at hockey as a business, it would probably be beneficial to the NHL and to USA Hockey to use the amateur side of it to expand the sport. So if you went back to promoting amateurs in the Olympics, not only might you expand the fan base, but all of a sudden you would rekindle the kind of popularity hockey has and maybe bring people into the pro ranks to the games and the on TV stuff, and that would help the NHL tremendously and the owners. And so from a business perspective, I think there's reasons also, not just, you know, the pluses of bring amateurs back like they did in 1960 and 1980 winning gold, bring amateurs into it because it's the best idea for the business of hockey.
Okay, there you have it. Jim, did you have a question?
Yeah, actually, well, just Bobby, when you were at Yale playing hockey, you played baseball as well, is that correct?
I did.
And doing some.
Enough, yeah.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say I was fortunate enough to play with some exceptional players on the baseball team, also.
And one of them was.
Well, we had our outfield at when Ron Darling wasn't pitching, and obviously he's a household name around New York. But when Ron Darling wasn't pitching, they rested him in right field because he was also a great hitter. Everyone knows of his pro career in pro baseball. Rich Diana was our center fielder, and he went on to play with the Miami Dolphins. And Joe Dufek was in left field, and he went on to play with the Seattle Seahawks. I held down the fort in the infield.
Now, and that's funny. That's coming from Yale. Now, great. Obviously, we don't have to talk about how great of a scholastic school it was, but to get pro athletes out of Yale, two football players, a baseball player, and a hockey player, that's pretty darn good. I mean, so you were kind of like the Chris Drury before Chris Drury. You were a good baseball player as well, holding down the infield for Yale.
I don't know if I was in Chris Drury's class. From what I gather, he was exceptional, and if my memory serves me right, didn't he win a Little League World Series?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. We hear about it all the time, Bob. They talk about it all the time in New York.
Well, that's nice that he has something else on his resume besides hockey. That's good.
He's going to need it if he keeps playing the way he's playing. Yeah. I'm only kidding. You know, I kid because I love. That's the reason. Now, Bob, I wanted to talk to you about Herb Brooks. Now, you played with Herb Brooks at two different teams. You played under the Rangers, and I'm sure, you know, that the movie came out and the whole thing, and you played with them also when you were at the North Stars. We kind of know the basis of what Herb Brooks was all about, but maybe you can lend your opinion, and I'm sure you've been asked this too. What kind of guy was Herb, and what was his approach to coaching?
It's interesting that you say that, because I learned a lot about how to describe Herb Brooks from talking with Rob McClanahan last Friday morning. Obviously, Rob had him for a number of years and had him with the Olympics, and then had him in the pro ranks for a brief period of time also. Herb was a master psychologist. Not only was his mind, in USA Hockey, his mind was way ahead of everybody else. I mean, he studied the Russians, he studied the Swiss, or the Swedes, and he studied the Finnish national team. And he had all kinds of thoughts and provocative ways to think about the game. And what people don't realize to this day about how Herb motivated was that he was a magician at forming a team. And I think that, you know, in some ways they exaggerated in the movie, from what I've been told from some of the guys from the 80 team.
Mm-hmm.
It probably didn't quite happen as fast as they say in the team. But he picked the best team, not necessarily the best players. And there's a difference there. And I've always said this, and you could probably look for any successful team. Go back to the Edmonton Oilers or the New York Islanders, you know, that won back-to-back-to-back Stanley Cups, or any of the Montreal teams, and you have superstars, and you have plumbers, and you have character guys, and you have leaders, and you have goaltending. And I mean, you have guys who play all the roles it takes to make a great collage, look great, and act great on the ice. And I think Herb was a magician in finding the right blend of talent. And over the course of the Olympic year in 1980, and I should say also, you know, his years at the University of Minnesota prior to that, he found ways to get all the team pulling in the right direction with the same end goal. And I think it culminated absolutely perfectly. You know, we all know that in Lake Placid.
And maybe you can hazard to guess why in the NHL, although he had some great range of teams that really ran into the buzzsaw, the New York Islanders, and you were, I think, part of one of those teams, the infamous Ken Morrow goal.
Oh, my gosh. Right through Glenn Hanlon's legs. I was on the ice.
And Bob, I gotta say,
you can hear the pain in his voice when he says that.
I don't mean
to laugh at it, but
no.
Well, the shift before
it sounds
the shift
like it really
before, I recall. Oh, it does. Well,
you know,
twice in that game, I had a chance to win it.
Don't worry, I've watched that video about 15 times.
I just had to get the puck up in the air over Billy Smith, and another time I passed it right on Mikko Leinen's stick.
And he
went to shoot it, and it went right over the top of the stick.
Yeah.
You know, and then they come down 30 seconds later and score.
You know, Bob, that's so funny that you mentioned that, because I think I was talking to Jim before the show. I said, well, we're going to have Bob Brook on the show. I said, I wonder if these guys remember this stuff. But, you know, I have the DVD of the game. You know, I get all the Ranger games, old Ranger games. I watch them. And when I want to torture myself, I watch that game. And I go, if...
Hopefully you don't watch it very often.
I'm not that much of a glutton for punishment. And I say to myself, I wonder if Bob Brook remembers that scoring chance, the couple chances he had in that game. Well, they just forget about it. They remember the Hanlon, you know, like you said, Ken Morrow throws a nothing shot towards the net. It goes between Hanlon's neck, between his goal pads. And I got to tell you, that was the lowest point I have ever been as a Ranger fan, and I'm sure you guys must have been devastated. So you really have thought about that game and what happened, what you could have done different?
Oh, sure. I mean, to this day, I wish I had developed more patience around the net. I wasn't blessed with the hands of Pierre LaRouche around the net. But... You know, there are a few instances in my career that always stand out and come back to haunt you when you think of it and say, wow, you know, that could have been my instant 15 minutes of fame in the New York Rangers uniform early in my career.
Yeah, and to tie that game was that controversial goal where Don Maloney, they said it was a high stick. If you look at the replay, it was a high stick. Nowadays, they would have disallowed that goal. But the Rangers came back to tie. They had him on the ropes, and I got to tell you, it was the most – I'm getting goose pimples thinking about how devastating. how was it in the locker room after that game? It must have been like a morgue in there.
Well, you know, it was quiet, and as a rookie joining the team that late in the season anyway, you know, I certainly wasn't going to say anything. It was a fantastic game, and everyone had their chances. And to lose it like that, you realize why there's reason for sometimes just throwing the puck on the net.
Yeah.
You know, I always laugh. I don't know whether it was – I think it was Mark Messier once said with the Edmonton Oilers. It might have been either he or Paul Coffey. In their prime, they told the rookies, they told all the guys, that, look, if you get tired on the ice – just dump it in their net and come off. And that kind of describes Ken Morrow. He's at the blue line, and you know, you're going out to just kind of get in his way, and he just kind of dumps it past you towards the net, and it flutters through.
Oh, I'm telling you, I get the bit of my stomach. It still hurts. And we have a live chat room that goes on, and one of the guys named Mandar says, that hurt so much. And he also says, didn't Gresh undress Ockman in that game? I don't remember that. Ron might have deked out Kaufman. I don't remember that. And then we have a young lady in here. She likes to throw the wise cracks. She wants me to ask you, how did you go from scoring 24 goals in 85-86 and then 6 goals? How did that happen?
I think the following year I get injured also. But
that's Karen. She's a wisecracker, so don't.
You're also. I was blessed to play with Ron Greschner. That year I scored, and Jan Eriksson when I scored a lot of goals, and had other years where I played with, you know, Donnie Maloney on the left side, or
yeah. I mean,
you know, we had a young team, we had a pretty good team, and we could mix it up quite a bit.
Yeah, and you know,
I guess the nature of the game. I think there was a year when I was playing with Ted Sater coaching when, you know, we were up late in the game and they pulled a goalie and he had so much faith in me to get out there and win the faceoff, and I was fast enough to. I probably scored 4 empty net goals that year.
Well, I'm going to tell you, you were part of that. You talked about that 85-86 team, and now this is now. Now, Ted Sater, we've had other ex-players who played for Ted, and some of them didn't have nice things to say about Ted, but the Rangers really made some noise that year. I have a video blog that I also do, and I actually put one of the games up from the, I think it might have been Game 5 or Game 6. I think it might have been Game 6. The crowd was so up, and you had some big goals in that, and I'm going to let Jim has a favorite memory about Bob Brook, and Jim, go ahead and tell your memory.
Well, I was at Game 4 when I think it was about 2.5 minutes to go. Bob tied the game, and then you won it in overtime. And I was right there behind the glass where you scored the goal. And I just remember the garden, unbelievable the level of noise in that place. And unfortunately it never gets that loud anymore. And I don't know why that is, but it just never sounds like. The thunder, I mean, it was just unbelievable when you scored that overtime goal that night. You guys were underdogs all the way, and you just kept, you were riding a hot goalie, and that was an incredible run you guys had.
Yeah, I'll share a story. Right before the tying goal, and it may even have been the exact shift before the tying goal, I'm standing almost in the exact same spot, and Wilf Paymont, to pull a name from way out of the past, is behind the net in the offensive zone fighting for the puck with their defenseman. And the puck comes loose about 3 feet behind the defenseman who's tying him up. And I step away from the front end of the net to go pick it up. Now, I would have been the first one there. And I'm halfway there, and he reaches out from being tied up from the boards and passes it right to where I was. And it would have been an open net goal, and now we're still down a goal. And I get back to the bench, and now I'm still young in my career, and he's been, I think, 14 years
ago. Yeah.
And he had some choice words to say for me, kind of, you know, not mixing words at all, saying, you know, I'll do my job, stay where you're supposed to, and I'll get you the puck. And so, you know, the next shift comes, and it's almost like deja vu. I see this happening like it's in slow motion. And he's behind the net again fighting for the puck. And I'm a young guy. I'm not leaving here. He's going to yell at me again. And sure enough, the puck comes right out, and we score the game-tying goal. You know, and that's, you know, that was a big lesson for me in getting to the point where you trust your other players to do their job and be in the right place for them to help you have success.
And getting back to what was your take on Ted Sater?
Ted was an interesting guy because I would call Ted the transition from old school coaching to new school. And by that, he probably worked harder and spent more time studying the game, studying the opposition, studying the other players, trying to figure out which player characteristics fit best with each other in organizing lines and so forth than any other coach I'd ever had. And I think that probably set him off a little bit from the administration, too, and that gosh, this guy's a little different than we've ever had before. But, you know, I got along with Ted, I think, simply because, one, he handed me the torch a number of times, said, you know, you're my guy, I need you to do this, and I was successful doing it, so he kept coming back to me. That was the year he put an A on my jersey. You know, he threw me out in all the situations, penalty killing. Occasionally I was on the power play. And no wonder I had some decent point scoring. But, you know, Ted rubbed some guys the wrong way because he wouldn't mix words. And he'd just say, look, you're this kind of player. I expect this out of you. And, you know, if a guy wasn't a goal scorer and he was a back checker, Ted would tell him that and say, I'm not asking you to go out and score goals, but you better not get scored against when you're on the ice. But guys then, if they had been in a previous part of their career a goal scorer, they didn't like hearing that. I can remember an instance during the playoffs against Philadelphia where Ted very quietly put up on the board for everybody to see when we walked into the locker room the weights of each of the players on Philadelphia's team. And he matched them with all the guys on our team, one-to-one, in various positions. And he goes, do you think Philadelphia is that tough? We outweigh them in almost every single position on this board. And it was kind of like, don't back down out there. Let's take the game to them. And you couldn't refute it, right? Because there it is. It's right on the black and white on the board. And so Philadelphia came running and gunning in Philadelphia. And I remember Brian McClellan dropped the gloves with somebody and just pummeled them. And we had like three fights in the first couple minutes, and we won all of them. And they tried to take the physical game to us, and we took it right back to them. And so we just ran them out of their own rink.
Yeah, you won the series in Philly. I mean, you know, you did. And that's the kind of approach where a lot of people may say simplistic, but it works. It got the message right there, and you guys executed. But, you know, his tenure there was it was so strange, as I remember. You know, he sent a lot of the veterans down in the beginning of the season. I think Pierre Leroux started the season in the minors. Do you know what was going on with that as far as Ted? And I know you were a young guy, and it was, you know, you were young yourself, but what was the whole reasoning behind that?
Well, it's interesting, and I don't know all of it, but I'll give you my take on it. Pierre was an old-school player. By that, I mean it wasn't riding a bike in between periods. It wasn't getting off of practice and going to ride, a bike or lift weights or do something else to set yourself off.
Right.
And Ted was the beginning, like I said earlier, of the new school.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to out-fitness them. We're going to outsmart them. We're going to out-coach them. We're going to out-play them. We're going to out-hit them. And in the end, we're going to outscore them and win. And I think Pierre and he didn't get along that way because he was expecting more from Pierre. Bring him in to the new school, the new way of playing, the new expectations, everything else. And instead, Pierre saying, I've been in this league for a long time. I score goals. Now, that's what I do. You want me to score goals? Fine. If you want me to back check, you're looking the wrong way.
Uh-huh.
So I remember he was in the minors, and I distinctly remember we were having trouble scoring goals, and late in the season he brought him up, and I think I think Ted literally said to Pierre, "All right, my mistake. I don't care what you do in the defensive zone. Do what you do best. Go score goals."
And he did.
And I remember a goal where in an awkward stance, the puck's coming, it's almost going behind him. He literally hit it in with the point of his stick. You know, it was in such a way he couldn't put his forehand on it, couldn't put a backhand on it. And he just kind of chipped it over the goalie with the point of his stick, like it's a skewer. And I'm going, you should have released those reins from him long ago. He would have scored 50 goals easily.
Yeah.
from what we saw during that stretch when he finally said, look, I don't care, just go do what you do best and score goals. And that was also a kind of a coming of age of Ted Seder. It wasn't just work and be smarter. It's, okay, let's work with the characters and the players you have on the team to make it all blend together right.
Right. And you know, Pierre, you know, he came alive, like you said. And I think that season you started with Terry Kleisinger in net. That was another thing that was, you know, it was just, I got to say, as a fan, you sit down going, what is this guy doing? And you know, and they send Pierre down. I think they sent Nicky Fatio down, too, which I think really put him in the doghouse as far as the Ranger fans were concerned. But then you did see a real defensive responsibility by the team, since you guys couldn't really score a lot of goals yet. Mike Ridley and Kelly Miller on that first line, you know, two great defensive players, and also could chip in some offense. Ridley, I think, led the team in points that year. You know, and it just started an idea, but then you guys, I'm telling you, you really picked it up and got it to the playoffs and made some noise. And if it wasn't for Patrick Waugh or Patrick Roy or whatever they called him at that time, I mean, you guys could have went to the Cup that year.
Yeah, I think we lost to Montreal, and they won the Cup that year.
Right. Yeah. And you know, those games were, you know, Waugh was the difference in most of those games, too. It wasn't like he just showed up. I mean, that really was his, I think, probably the you know, his jumping-off point. Unfortunately, it had to come at the Rangers' expense, but... So, you know, that was interesting. And like I say, Jim was at that Washington game. And can you tell the fans what it is to play in New York and experience that whole, you know, the craziness of New York and the fans?
Yeah, there's a quote from my father that kind of sums it up in some ways. You talked earlier about, you know, how noisy the Garden could get and how noisy it was during the playoffs when we beat Washington in overtime. There was a playoff game, and my parents came down from Boston to watch, and I remember we won, and I don't even recall whether I played well or not, but we won. And, to start the game, you know, they start the national anthem, and it doesn't matter.
Right.
What's going on? So my dad summed it up this way. He goes, he's laughing. He goes, you know what, and he's a, you know, 160-pound engineer, you know, rocket scientist from MIT, and a quiet guy. And he goes, I could have sang the national anthem because it didn't matter. Nobody could hear him anyway with the fans being as loud as they are. And, yeah, and that was Madison Square Garden. That was our home ice advantage.
So it's funny, and I think we got a phone call, Jim, we got a phone call on the line for Bob Brook, who played in a loud Madison.
Yeah, let me see. James, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing, guys?
Hi, James.
Hello,
welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks. Appreciate it. How you doing, Bob?
Good.
Do you have a question for Mr. Bob Brook?
Oh, of course I do, my friend. Bob... you were saying about Ted Seder and the new style. Did you adapt to that pretty quickly? Did you get to understand it, you know, pretty easy, or was it something that was more difficult to do, or something totally way out there, or was it something you were able to handle pretty easily?
No, it probably fit my style almost perfectly. You know, I was always, I was pretty fast, but I always worked hard. I like to pride myself on outworking somebody. You know, if I can't outsmart him position-wise. And I think that fit well with Ted. You know, what also worked well for me was because I hadn't been in the league long enough to establish any old-school, new-school strategies or game plans or lifestyles or anything like that. You know, kind of what I went through with college hockey and then the Olympics just kind of carried into the NHL. I was so early in my career that I was probably pretty easy for Ted to mold.
Gotcha.
Because I didn't have any type of set style that he had to change.
Right.
So you were just, you know, you're basically trying to make the team. And listen, you were a lunch pail type of guy. I mean, you had some offensive skill. I mean, you know, we know that. I mean, you had 20-plus goals. But you were kind of, you were a worker bee. I mean, that's how you made it. Am I correct in that summation?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting as I've gotten further and further away from my playing days. You know, I look back and I see high school hockey now and college hockey, and a lot of times the differences between success or different levels of success isn't necessarily ability, it's opportunity. And I can tell you a story about Dave Gagne. Dave Gagne was, you know, in the minors with New York Rangers for a long time.
He
comes back into the NHL, and they sent him down after training camp in the North Stars organization. He was about to quit. And he goes, I can't play any better than that. You guys, I can't go down anymore. And they said, no, you'll be our first guy called up. And they stuck with their plan, and they called him up in the second week of the season or something like that, and they put him on the power play. They said, we're going to give you a chance to show what you can do. And he scores 2 goals that night, and 2 nights later he gets another goal and an assist. And, you know, so it's not like he all of a sudden got better. It was all of a sudden he was given an opportunity to showcase his talents. And I think that's the difference in a lot of cases. So, you know, when you go back and you look at someone's career, a lot of times it's, was he given the opportunity to showcase his talents? Was he on the power play? Was he playing with,
right?
You know, pick somebody and put him on a line with Mario Lemieux or Crosby or Wayne Gretzky and
oh yeah, you look at
they're gonna get, they should be donating half of
their salary
earnings
right
later, you know. Because they're going to look better, they're going to be a better player. Whereas now the game's so penalty filled and it's special teams, you know, if you're not on one of the specialty teams,
you're not going to get a lot of minutes.
How do you showcase yourself? Yeah, how do you showcase yourself?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we can remember Chris Kontos had a great career, or 1-year, 2-year career playing with Mario Lemieux. You know, I mean, you're right. It's all about opportunity. I guess it's even the same thing with, like, any kind of a thing where it involves talent. You kind of got to be in the right place at the right time and do the right thing and shine when it's your moment. And you were talking about Dave Gagne. I mean, the Rangers had him up, like you said, a couple times. Nothing really from the outside observer. You could really see anything special. And then, you know, he gets his break with Minnesota, and he has an 8-to-10-year career. Good defensive guy, old, you know, a good player. And we have a question from the chat room, and this one is coming from Paulie D. Paulie D wants to know, who was the most gifted player that you played with in your career? He wants to know that.
Gifted?
Gifted.
Probably Kent Nielsen.
Great.
Here in Minnesota. I like to say, I mean, Kent, one of the few players ever who could stick handle inside a phone booth. Absolute phenomenal talent, all the gifts in the world. Now, I played with him here in Minnesota nearer the end of his career. He went on to go back to Sweden and play there for a while. But pure talent-wise, probably Kent Nielsen. Speed, hands, everything.
Hey.
But when you talk to all-around game, including vision and elevating the players around them, you know, I like to say, obviously, Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux. Wayne Gretzky built a team around him by making everyone that much better. One-on-one, Mario Lemieux was probably the most dangerous person in the league because he could just make you look so foolish. Those aren't surprises to anybody who's listening, but I think, you know, gifted, probably just pure, outright, raw talent. And hands, Kent Nielsen.
I mean, he piled up a lot of. He was an assist guy primarily with the Flames, and you know. And like you said, it's interesting that you said that he had that great stick handling skills. And maybe it was a product, maybe didn't get as much recognition because of the teams he played on at the time. And I wanted to talk a little about Minnesota. I mean, you know, Minnesota is near and dear to your heart and the whole bit and the whole thing. And I wanted to know why do you think hockey did not succeed in the first go around in Minnesota while you played there, and it's such a success now with the Wild?
Well, you know, again, I look at things more from a business perspective now, and I think the ownership of the team back when the old Met Center was here and the old North Stars, they didn't treat the marketing of the team like this was, we have to go out and get and generate fan interest, get them to buy tickets, get them to buy merchandise, all that stuff. It was, we're playing a game here, they should come see us. And unfortunately in Minnesota, it's such a hockey town that you're playing home on a Saturday night, you're competing with the high school hockey games, you're competing with youth hockey games, all the same guys that you wanted to sell tickets to had games and obligations of their own. And I think if they had looked at that and actually studied it, then have a 1 o'clock game on Saturday so that all those ticket sales could go and make it a hockey day. They'd come to the NHL game, watch the Minnesota North Stars play, and then go back home and grab something to eat in the afternoon or whatever and go to their own game at night. You know, and so I think there was a marketing, you know,
it was a marketing
chasm, if you will, just between what they should have been looking at and how they were marketing the team. The other side of it is, you know, I don't know that they ever really stood out in the public franchises here against the Twins and obviously the Vikings as being fan favorites. Hockey, this is the land of hockey out here, but it's kind of the land of youth hockey, not necessarily pro hockey.
Right.
The new team, the Wild, one, they have a phenomenal stadium to go watch a game in.
That's what I keep hearing.
People can go there. Yeah, people go in there. They're entertained. They're not entertained just by the product that's on the ice. They're entertained by the restaurants in the building and the bars in the building and places to just lounge around. And I mean, I've known people that go to a game and they hardly see a period or a period and a half. You know, they're just having fun connecting with it. It's a place to
right.
go and have a night out. So it's a much more entertaining atmosphere here now, and that probably goes for a lot of the new arenas and teams that are playing in new arenas. It's a destination.
But you know what, Bob? Being a Ranger fan from back, you know, we used to go to games in the early 80s. We didn't have anything in MSG, I mean, at the time of the game. I don't know. I haven't been there in a while. I live down in Florida now, but the most anybody would do is get up out of their seat between periods, smoke a cigarette in the corridor, and come right back to their seat. We were so into the game and so loud and raucous and ruckus, whatever you word it is, and we just loved watching the game. And I was really shocked myself, when I found out that the North Stars were moving down to Dallas. So, you know, I mean, is that what it really takes? In other words, something to have a little more than just the hockey there? But then, like you said, I guess it was because of this high school and college and stuff like that.
That's part of it. I mean, part of the reason people think of the team didn't make it here, so that they left and went down to Dallas. Well, it comes back to the business. So at that point, Norm Green, he was trying to get an upgrade to the Met Stadium, the Met Center where we played, where there's luxury boxes, and he was asking the Metropolitan Council for a couple million dollars to upgrade things. And they kept saying no. They kept saying no. And here's Dallas offering him, a huge financial package to move his franchise down there. So it becomes, once again, it's a business, and he's a businessman, and this was in his best interest to move the franchise.
Yeah. I mean, you have to also, James,
yeah.
You have to understand that, the Rangers are an original six team. They had their fan base. You know, Minnesota – was an expansion franchise. I mean, we talk way back when, and they had to compete with college hockey. And today's hockey is all about marketing. Even today, the Rangers don't have to market to get people in their building. And Minnesota, the Wild, have done a fantastic job of grassroots movement in getting the marketing out there and the word out about the Wild. And that, it's like Bob said, that's been the key to their success. But James, I think we got another phone call. We got pressed for time here.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, James.
Perfect. Perfect.
All right, we want to take another call. Bob, we got a call from up in your neck of the woods. I believe this is Minnesota. 612-987, you're on Blue Shirt Banner Radio.
Hi, I just got a quick question for you. My name is Brian. I'm just wondering if you ever had great hockey hair.
probably back in my college days, sure, it was flying out all the holes in the helmet and everything else, but I don't know I'd ever put myself in that great hockey hair category.
Not like a Brian Engblom or Brian still got that mullet going.
I don't know if Brian ever had it in the great hockey hair. I mean, great hockey hair was Ron Duguay.
Oh, jeez, yeah. He still has it. He's still got that Bon Jovi look going.
Now, see, I knew Bob was up in Minnesota. I saw the call pop up on the switchboard. I knew it was the Minnesota area code. I figured, okay, we'll have a nice connection here. And the guy asked a question about Bob's hair.
Perfect. I'm happy that I still have some. So, if there was a day when it was flying out of my helmet, that's a good thing.
We have another question from the chat room. Stan wants to know, why did you wear number 13? Were you anti, you weren't very superstitious then if you wore number 13?
And here's a word for you for everyone to take into, their work tomorrow. Triskaidekaphobia. It's a big word, but it's just fear of the number 13. I didn't know that, until I started playing for Herb Brooks. He told me about it, but... no, it was very simple. 3 was my favorite number, and I had 3 in a number of different teams in high school. And I went to 13 because at the time, 3 was taken. So 13 was the next number that had a 3 in it. And it kind of stuck to me saying, and no one else wants it. So, hey, great. Here's a number that I like, and nobody else wants it, so I'll take it.
I think you're the first person ever to mention triskaidekaphobia on this show, probably the last.
Hey, 13 worked out all right for Dan Marino, right?
I would say 13's probably worked out for a number of different players who wore the number. Dan Marino would be near the top.
I can't believe our first call from Minnesota, and he asked about hockey yet. I thought it was going to be.
The hockey hair is coming back. I mean, the kids nowadays, they want to wear their hair a little longer. They want to, they like it flying. In the old days when you could go warm up without a helmet on too.
But Bob, we got a couple minutes here left, and I'm telling you, time flies. I have a lot of fun talking to you. I just wanted to get your we talk a lot to the players who played in the 80s and 90s. What's your take on the game today? Do you still follow it? And what's your overall – now, I heard you allude to all the penalties and all that stuff, and that's a part of the game I think that we're really disappointed with. There's just too much specialty teams and not enough five-on-five play. What's your take on the game, and do you still follow it?
I follow it. Love watching the playoffs because I think – the playoff forces all the players, good and bad, and the tops in the league and the fourth line players, all to elevate their game. So I'm really keyed in on the game in the playoffs. But as far as the game and the changes, I think the NHL has done a lot of good things in the rule changes over the last couple of years to bring offense back into it. We need to do something to get away from this, neutral zone trap. It's as boring as can be, and eventually, the students of the game will go somewhere else because they don't want to go watch a boring hockey game. It's too expensive nowadays. The one thing I would like to see come back into it, and I suppose there are two things, but the first would be, let's get back to where you can actually tie somebody up along the boards. Just tie them up so that someone else on your team, hopefully, can come along and pick up the puck. And the reason I say that is I'd like to filter that down to the youth levels and go back to reinforcing why the physical aspect of the game is in the game. It used to be to separate the guy with the puck from the puck. And it's gotten to the point where it's used for an intimidation point of view and not for its original intention. Now, if you took back the idea of, instead of moving the puck along the boards and not being able to pin somebody there, just pin them. And you wouldn't, you see nowadays they're spending all the time in the corners, and I think that's kind of boring. If you pin them, either the puck's there and you get a whistle and you start again, or someone else is going to pick up the puck and you're no longer just watching this guy face to the boards, just kind of protecting the puck and nothing happens. And the second thing I'd like to see change is, there's a reason fighting was always in hockey. When Wayne Gretzky got hit, Dave Semenko was going to climb into your shirt the next time you were on the ice. It was just an unwritten rule.
Right.
And it allowed Wayne Gretzky to showcase his skills and elevate his team and bring the brand of hockey that was exciting onto the ice. And nowadays, you can't have that guy kind of self and reinforce what's going on with the better players and the skilled players and the superstars of the game, because they're in the penalty box for a 2-minute instigating penalty and then a fighting penalty or whatever it is, and the game is so specialty teams related that it hurts. I'd like to see that change a little bit because, very rarely does anybody really get hurt in a fight in the NHL.
Right.
Not seriously hurt. And yet it's kind of a self-policing mechanism to keep the skilled players doing exactly what they're supposed to do. I mean, I think there was a time last year during the season when almost 120 players in the NHL on rosters were out with injuries or sickness or whatever. And when you're talking, the superstars of the game, whether it's a Crosby or a Ovechkin or anybody else along those lines, the NHL is not a business that can survive rules that allow the superstar players to not be in the lineup when people are paying, hefty prices for tickets. So I think they really should address that.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, first of all, they put in all these rules and they really clamped down on the holding and the clutch and the grab. Like you said, pinning the guy. And these were basic tenets of the game of hockey for years, all in the good name of getting goal scoring. And, I mean, every stat that you look at will show you that goal scoring has not gone up. If anything, it's gone down. Because the specialty teams, it's not so special to be, it takes the word right out of it. If you're killing 6 power plays, 7 power plays a night, you hone those skills, you work on those skills. And it really hasn't improved scoring. It's the same thing with the 4-on-4 in overtime, the skills competition that I call the shootout. It hasn't made the game any more exciting or loosened things up. And they have the recent head injuries that you've seen in the league are not also they're because the players aren't allowed to police the team with the instigator rule. A lot of these things can be taken care of by the players themselves, but they're hindered by the rules. And you talk to ex-player after ex-player and people who've played the game. We got Gary Bettman in here. He's never played a game. I don't think he even saw a hockey stick before he decided to become the commissioner. He was a basketball guy. And it's not work. It's not working, and, you know, you're a business guy. You know, if things aren't working, you got to change the game plan. And it looks like stubborn.
If you're an owner and you've got three of your top five superstars, you know, earning, you know, 3, 5, 7, whatever it is, $1 million a year out due to injury, I would be complaining about what the rules are saying and bringing the game to, because that's telling me something's wrong if these guys are out. You know, world-class athletes out due to injury in a sport that shouldn't have that being happening. So, I think it should be addressed. And, you know, I see it at the youth level. Unfortunately, this whole idea of, you know, focusing on no checking from behind and not being able to pin somebody on the boards. Well, if you're not being able to pin somebody on the boards, then you're telling them it's okay to turn their back to you in their effort to try and protect the puck. So now they're 2 feet or 3 feet away from the boards with their back to you. That is the absolute worst place to be for head injuries, back injuries, and everything else. In an inadvertent hit, you get out of balance, and you're going to hit hard and awkwardly. And we see it at the youth level every single night I go to a high school game. I'm astounded that these kids are basically, because of the rule changes, they're being forced to turn their back on the guy that's about to hit them, or trying to hit him, or trying to get the puck. And, it's simple. If you just allow that guy, instead of having to stay off him, to be able to move him to the boards and pin him there, then the next guy, now it's a 4-on-4, and your defense partner or your center is going to pick up the puck in the defensive zone, and off you go. It's an interesting game now, and I'm kind of glad I played the game when I did. But, you know, they're working on trying to make it more offensive, and that's a good thing.
And you're right about the playoffs. I find that the playoffs are much more entertaining than the regular season, just because they do allow kind of the old-time hockey to go on, you know, when you play. They're a little bit looser with the rules. This year they've been a little bit looser than they usually have been. They're not calling all the ticky-tack stuff that we saw in the previous season.
I had someone speak to me about a rules change that they should consider. And I think it was on the phone with somebody in the last couple of days. He said, you know, maybe they should consider you're only allowed to hit somebody in your defensive zone.
Huh.
Got it. So,
yeah, but
I'm not exactly sure what to do, but it would bring some offense back into the game, because you wouldn't have the forwards in their offensive zone.
Right. There'd be no reason to...
There was no reason to hit. I mean,
but no reason,
you know,
to forecheck.
You want to you want to separate somebody from the puck, but you want to focus completely on offense. You want to keep control of the puck, because you don't have the ability to go, you know, run somebody through the boards to try and get it back. So don't give up the puck there. So now you get creativity back and puck possession back in the offensive zone.
Bob, I can't see any more. I can't take any more physical. I think I'm going to not watch the sport to take any more physical play away from it. So I don't think I could cope with that.
I agree with you, but you know what? To really learn where the game is going, now, caveat that by saying the recent rule changes at the NHL have yet to filter down to the youth levels, but the game at the high school level and college level, while it's extremely fast, it's almost stupid physical. I mean, these guys are getting their head snapped back and fixing their face mask every single time they touch the puck.
Uh-huh.
And if they didn't have those masks, those kids would be called for elbowing or cross-checking or high-sticking every single time. But because nobody's getting hurt, there's no bloody lip, there's no scratched chin, you know, that there are no penalties being called.
Uh-huh.
Shame on the refs, but you know, you think that there's injuries in the pro ranks, you should see what's coming out of the high school ranks. I mean, these kids, it's going to get murderous.
And I wasn't aware of that, and that's a fantastic point. I mean, what happens when these guys get to the NHL level or the AHL level or, you know, whatever? And, you know, they're used to coming in on guys like this who don't, you know, in the AHL, the mask, they're mandatory. But in the NHL, you're really going to see, you know, nonsense that really doesn't belong.
Well, it's interesting. I was at a game the other night, and, I mean, I've got a goalie in college now, and, you know, I'm looking at some of the teams are coached, and there is absolutely no fear charging the net because they're so well protected and their face is so well protected and neck, everything else. And the post moves, so the net moves. I mean, it's not anchored in like it used to be. And there's no respect for your own face because it's completely protected. Nobody would go face first into a pile in front of the net to try and get a loose puck or try and, you know, knock the goalie loose in your way of trying to get past the defenseman, you wouldn't do it. You at least be sure about it. Now it happens, you know, it happens 10 times a game at the high school and college level.
Uh-huh. And in the NHL level, they've really just tied the defenseman's hands as far as – I kind of the equivalent of like the defensive backs against the wide receivers in football. I feel like they just can't do their job back there. Their powers, they tie up sticks. That's all they can do. And, you know, and that even adds more concern, you know. And, well, I got to say, Bob, we have gone over time. We're into what we call podcast mode. That means if anybody wants to listen to this in its entirety, they now can go back and listen to the whole show and tell everybody about this show because it's like, you know, we got a lot of people. It's taken off, and I really appreciate you, coming on the show. And I have to ask you a question. We got one more question from the chat room. This comes from Ricky O. He wants to talk about your fight with Ray Newfield of the Hartford Whalers, a fight he says that you destroyed Ray Newfield.
You know, I think I learned my first fight against Dave Langevin where he came behind the net to hit me and I put my stick up to protect myself and probably cross-checked him right in the chin. But and then the puck went back to the point and I came around the front of the net and tried to get there for a tip-in. And when I turned around to try and get the rebound, Dave Langevin just hit me across the eyebrow with one punch and cut me for 13 stitches. I think I learned after that one fight, if there was going to be a fight, it's certainly better to start it and finish it early. I don't recall the Newfield. I know I connected pretty well with him up in Hartford. What I will tell you is that my grandmother was in the stands, and she didn't like it very much.
Oh, man.
So, anyway, you guys,
that's funny.
You guys
have
been great.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, the one thing I was just going to say is that, Bob, you are probably, I would think, at least the fourth or fifth former player that we've been that we've had on that has said the exact same thing. I sure am glad I played when I did. Right, Eddie?
Yeah. I mean, that's been a constant.
When they talk about
like,
today's game, so many of you have said the same thing, that you're so glad you played when you did and not today.
Yeah, I mean, we've had players that said the game is unrecognizable to me now because, you know, forwards, I have to tell you, you know, we were there to hold up wingers and do this stuff. Now you'd get called for a penalty. I mean, I throw on some of these old games, I can go penalty here, penalty there, penalty here. I mean, we went by the rules of today if you watch an old game now. I mean, it's a little absurd with the two-referee system, doesn't help things. But, Bob, we loved having you on this show. You were great. I just want to ask you in parting, who do you root for now? Are you a Wild fan? Or are you a – don't worry. But
you know what? From a local point of view, I'm definitely a Wild fan. But, you know, a large part of my heart is still with the Rangers. I turned pro with the Rangers. I had some of my best seasons there. I love Madison Square Garden. So, I'm still a Ranger fan.
All right, Bob. We love you and we love having you on this show and don't for a minute think we don't remember Bob Brook in the letter I sent you. We do. We remember these guys and we remember your chance in the Morrow game, but Hey, Jim told you, my co-host. He was there when you scored that game in the Garden, and people still talk about that series against the Caps and how loud it was at Madison Square Garden and this day. And we really appreciate you joining us tonight.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and thanks for having me, guys. That's great.
We love to have you.
All right, take care.
Okay.
All right, feel free. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Okay, take care. And there he goes, ladies and gentlemen. The great. We always say the great, don't we? 2 hours and 23 minutes of internet radio, free of charge, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right. Everybody's a legendary fan with us.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Bob.
And are you there?
What's that?
Well, I got to say.
Okay.
He loosened up great. We got him talking. He went from
being Joe Patterson to John O'Grodnik in the span of one phone call. I mean, I'm sitting there, the first like half hour or so, and I'm like, and it's not that he didn't talk. He was really, really dry, very not much humor coming out. And then, after a while, he started to loosen up. And now I'm like, okay, show's over. He's still talking. and it was like all the questions I had, he had like kind of skimmed across his career. I had some early questions. I wanted to talk to him about playing baseball a little bit, what that was like, because I knew he had Ron Darling on his team. And he's like, yeah, I played baseball. And I was like, all right. How many radio interviews is Bob Brook doing? So, he probably, had to loosen up a little bit.
Yeah. No, he was good. He was good. He got better as it went on. And I actually worked the conference call thing.
For all we know, the last time he was interviewed was Stan Fischler on Sports Channel when Bob Brook was with the Devils.
That's right.
That might have
been
his last interview.
I call Mandar Stan. I just want to be
Stan.
I just.
He's our Stan Fischler.
Oh no.
No. I just call him Stan. I wanted to mix it up. I didn't want to go into explaining what Mandar meant for the hundredth guest.
Oh.
What's a Mandar,
Gotcha.
That's cool. And Jess Rubenstein was good. And
He's very good.
Tuesday. And Mandar, I'm sorry to get in touch with you about the show or anything. It's crazy going nuts over here.
No. I saw it online, so I just wanted to make sure to call another.
Okay. All right, fellas, I got to take a whiz and I got to get out of here. But
sounds good. Talk to you guys later.
Take care.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Good night.
Good night.